From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. ISIS celebrated its one-year anniversary this week. It's been working hard to get its message out to the Arab world and to the West, with some success. Schoolgirls from London, a couple in Frankfurt, men from Minnesota committed to the caliphate. We'll look at the story of a 23-year-old American woman named Alex from Washington State who all but made the trip to join ISIS. This hour on Point, a deep look at ISIS online efforts to woo Westerners and Alex's remarkable story. You can join us on air or online. Is ISIS unstoppable? Do you understand how young Americans can get caught up in this? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. We begin first with the warning from the Department of Homeland Security and the FBI of a possible terror threat this July 4th weekend. ISIS has been calling for homegrown attacks. And joining me now from Washington is Donna Linewand-Leger, who covers terrorism for USA Today. Donna, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. Happy to join you.
Thank you. So the Department of Homeland Security, the FBI, the National Counterterrorism Department, all have issued a joint intelligence bulletin to law enforcement across the U.S. What are they saying?
So what they're saying is something that they have said many times before and on many holidays, that they are asking law enforcement around the country to be extra vigilant as the July 4th holiday is upon us. Now, they don't have what they call a specific credible threat, which means they don't have any knowledge of a particular terrorist attack that's in the works or aimed at a particular venue, but they're just saying be extra vigilant.
Yeah. Here's an interview with Fox News' Megyn Kelly on Monday. Republican Representative Peter King from New York expressing his concerns over the potential ISIS attack on the 4th of July, saying this is the most concerned he'd been or he'd seen the FBI and Homeland Security.
In the last week alone, the last 10 days, we've had five different arrests in New York of ISIS supporters. These are people the FBI believes are involved in potential terrorist activities. And to have five individuals arrested over such a brief period of time in one geographic area, that's just one further indication. And there's others, I believe, out there of the potential of an attack.
Donna, you're right. It seems we do get these threat warnings around holidays, the 4th of July, of course. It seems the vigilance surrounding this year's warning carries added weight, however.
You know, it does. And there are a couple of different things in play. So let me start with the three things that are in play, you know, very often when we get these increased, increased terror alerts. One is significant dates. We know that people who plan terror attacks tend to like holidays and anniversaries, as we experienced with the Boston Marathon bombing, which happened on Patriots Day. They like events. They like something that draws a large crowd into an area. And that would happen on the 4th of July in places like the National Mall. And they like a soft target, which is, you know, something like the National Mall, which is the grassy area that stretches from the Lincoln Memorial to the Capitol. A lot of people are going to gather there, and there's no hard security there. Anyone is sort of free to go. It's not like the Pentagon, which is fortified.
Right.
But what makes it special this time is that there have been calls from the Islamic State, from ISIS, for lone wolf attacks, for supporters to act during what is now the holy month of Ramadan. And it happens to coincide with July 4th.
Mm, right. Lone wolf attacks during Ramadan. Here's ABC News reporting on Monday on the arrest of Alaa Saleh from New York, who was arrested for allegedly conspiring with ISIS.
Alaa Saleh's arrest illustrates the heightened concern the FBI has over the power of the ISIS social media campaign. His lawyer says the American-born suspect had a decent work history and no criminal record.
So on June 16th, CBS News reported on the arrest of Munther Omar Saleh, a 20-year-old New York college student accused of trying to plan an attack also in New York City.
Federal investigators say the case began on the George Washington Bridge, where the suspect, 20-year-old Munther Omar Saleh, was allegedly seen loitering on it 2 days in a row, on March 22nd and March 23rd. That sparked months of intense surveillance, which feds say yielded this evidence on the suspect's private computer, internet searches for weapons, building explosives, pressure cookers, eluding police, and disguises, specifically beards and wigs.
Right. And so that terror suspect, Donna, allegedly emailing himself information on, as we hear there, building a pressure cooker bomb like the one used at the Boston Marathon.
Yeah, so this is, we've been seeing these kind of arrests go on for over a year. I think by my count, there have been at least 49 arrests in the United States for people who have ISIS-related, issues. They've either sought to join ISIS in Syria, going through Turkey. They have plotted or talked about planning attacks here in the United States. And, you know, that is a lot. And I think it was an LAPD official who said yesterday that the threat stream was the highest he had seen or heard about since 9/11. And, the threat stream is what it's what they call chatter. It's talk about possible attacks.
Well, FBI Director James Comey talks about this new landscape of terror and its shift in focus from tracking radicalized Americans who want to fight ISIS abroad to those who want to stay home and plot their attacks, Donna. Talk about the ISIS terror attacks abroad. We've seen what's happened in France, Tunisia, Kuwait, and yesterday in Egypt. 17 Egyptian soldiers killed. ISIS was known exclusively for its activities in Iraq and Syria until recently.
Yeah, they seem to be able to gather a following all around the world. And it's very interesting how they're doing it. They're really working very hard through social media. They have a glossy online magazine. They have recruitment videos that are sophisticated and entertaining. And they seem to be able to draw supporters all over the world who are using their materials, things like how to put together bombs and they're posting how to do a terror attack online, taking this information, putting it together, and putting together their own attacks, getting like-minded supporters to go and attack soft targets, for example, that beach resort in Tunisia.
Highest threat stream since 9/11. Donna Leinwand-Leger covers terrorism for USA Today. She spoke with me from Washington. Donna, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Now to how ISIS is recruiting Westerners. Joining me now from Dakar, Senegal, is Rukmini Kalamaki. She's a correspondent for The New York Times and writer of the outstanding article in Sunday's paper, ISIS and the Lonely Young American. You can link to the article on our website, onpointradio.org. Rukmini, welcome to the program. Nice to have you.
Thank you so much, Jane.
Well, your story really caught our attention. It was such a powerful example of how ISIS is recruiting young Westerners, young Americans. How did you first learn about this young woman named Alex?
Well, as your other guest pointed out, ISIS is very sophisticated on social media, and they have a very large presence on Twitter. So all of us who are covering and following this group are watching these alleged ISIS accounts on Twitter very carefully. And it was in the course of doing this that an online activist that I know pointed out to me that there was a young woman. He thought she was a teenager because she was posting in a way that made her seem much younger than her 23 years, and he pointed her out to me, and I began corresponding with her first on Twitter, and then later by phone, and then finally in person.
So here she is, Alex, the subject of your article, in a video for the New York Times, describing where she lives.
I live in like a modular home with my grandparents, and it's in the middle of nowhere. We lived in the city; we could walk wherever we wanted. And here, it was a lot better in a lot of ways because it was safer, but it was also, because it was also safer, it was a lot more boring. I've met my friends on the internet. I have more community with them than I have with people in my own community.
23 years old, lives in a modular home with her grandparents. She was a Sunday school teacher, Rukmini. She loved to babysit. She went to malls, watched Netflix. I mean, you're sort of typical average American teenager / young adult. How did she become interested in ISIS in the first place?
In many ways, she is a typical young adult, but in other ways, she's not. She's incredibly isolated, as she described in that clip, and she's also underemployed. When I met her, she was working just two days a week, babysitting, and then she was teaching Sunday school on Sunday morning, and the rest of the time was just this, you know, this open canvas, and she doesn't have a lot of money, so among the things she told me that she did was, you know, her idea of fun was going to Taco Bell and sharing a $2.99 burrito with her best friend, and going to the mall by herself and essentially going up and down the escalators for fun.
So this is a
young person
isolated
who's,
and underemployed,
yes.
Right? Then how did she get contact with ISIS?
Yes. It happened last August when James Foley was beheaded. She saw the news, you know, on her phone, and like many of us, she was shocked and upset, and she wanted to learn more. And so she went on Twitter because, like young people everywhere, she's active on Twitter. And very quickly, she realized that the people who had done this atrocity were actually on Twitter, and she began asking them questions. First, aggressively, you know, why did you do this? Why would you be so mean? Who are you to judge this young journalist? And she was thrown off by the fact that A, they responded to her, and B, that they were polite, they were kind, and you know, as young people sometimes are, she was not able to differentiate, you know, the apparent act of kindness that they were showing her when they spoke to her in a nice manner, and put that aside from their atrocities.
And quickly before our break here, what was their initial message to her? What was the draw? What was the pull?
I think very quickly, within a couple of weeks of first starting to interact with them, she was spending up to 7 hours a day talking to them. They were, you know, they were courting her the way you would court perhaps a lover.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashworth. We're talking about ISIS's efforts to recruit Westerners and the story of a Washington State 23-year-old named Alex who taught Sunday school and got caught up in the ISIS cause. You can join the conversation. What should the U.S. strategy be when tens of thousands of people are spreading the ISIS propaganda machine online? Should we be spending more to stop them online than on the battlefield? I'm speaking this hour with Rukmini Kalamaki, correspondent for The New York Times. Her article in Sunday's New York Times was ISIS and the Lonely Young American. Rukmini, you've set up Alex as a 23-year-old, lives with her grandparents, online now talking to ISIS recruiters 7 hours a day. Can you describe their conversations?
What's striking about their conversation is if you look at the back and forth and the transcripts which she shared with me, is that I would say more than 90% of it is just innocent banter. It sounds like two teenagers joking, you know, smiley faces, LOL, how are you, how's your grandma? And that's what I think is so insidious about it, because ISIS has understood very well the notion that in order to recruit somebody, you need to draw close to them, you need to gain their confidence, and you do that by essentially becoming their best friend.
So who became her contact within ISIS then?
She was talking with about two dozen people who either identified themselves as members of the Islamic State or else as supporters of ISIS. At first, her initial contact was a man called Manzer. That was, I'm sure, his pseudonym. And he told her that he was an ISIS fighter based on the front lines near Damascus in Syria. And he's the person who brought her from the initial contact to the point of considering converting. Then he disappears. She assumes, we don't know, but she assumes that he was killed because he just dropped off from one day to the next. And then a man called Faisal Mustafa, who is actually a citizen of the United Kingdom and who lives near Manchester, stepped in. And he took her through the conversion and then to the point where she's discussing marrying a 45-year-old man who was described as bald, unattractive, but a good Muslim. And she still somehow considered that, you know, attractive.
Here she is, Alex, in an interview with you, with the New York Times, speaking about her experience with Fazel, this British man with ties to ISIS. Alex converted to Islam following conversations with him, and he sent her a number of free gifts over the months they communicated.
The first thing they told me was I was not allowed to listen to music. The second thing they told me is, like, how to pray. They did tell me that it is a sin to live, to stay in non-Muslim lands if you have a chance to go to Muslim lands. Because why would we stay in the land of disbelievers and doubters?
So this is a man who was acquitted in England on terror charges, Rukmini. He sent her packages, he sent
yes.
her gifts. But how she converted to Islam on Twitter is important to note.
Yes, she. The day that she decided to convert was December 28th of last year, just a couple days after Christmas, which, if you remember that she's a Sunday school teacher, is actually a very meaningful time of the year for a Christian. And what is shocking about it is that at that point in time, and actually to this day, she had not yet met a single Muslim in real life. Mm. Not one. The only Muslims she knew were people she was talking to on social media. And they convinced her that in order to convert to Islam, all you need to do is repeat the Shahada, which is the declaration of Muslim faith, and that you need to do it in the presence of two Muslim witnesses. And so she, you know, she brought up the fact that she doesn't know any Muslims in real life. And they said, that's OK. You can post it on Twitter. And the first two people who acknowledge your declaration of faith will count as your witnesses. And so she did. And she described to me how she was sitting in her bedroom in this modular home in Washington State, surrounded by, you know, hundreds of acres of alfalfa fields, as her family was literally in the next room watching Fox News. She sits on her bed. On her bookshelf is a crucifix. On her desk is a framed verse from the gospel. And she said that she almost felt like throwing up. But at the same time, she was excited. She was enticed. And so she just opened up her laptop and typed in this unfamiliar phrase, and immediately her declaration was acknowledged by Faisal, this man in Britain, and also by a woman who went by the pseudonym Haley Sheikh. This user, we don't know where she lives or what her real name is. She appears later in the Twitter timeline of the Texas shooter, Elton Simpson, the man who led the attack on the Muhammad cartoon drawing competition.
Right.
And immediately after, within hours of her conversion, she had doubled her Twitter following. And if you look at her timeline, it's just filled with, you know, well-wishers. You know, congratulating her, welcoming her, showering her with attention and with love. And for a young person, you know, who is isolated, lonely, she hadn't been in a relationship for several years, there is something life-affirming about that.
She found a community, right? So Alex's grandmother grew suspicious at this point, tried to stop Alex from communicating with Faisal. What happened?
She grew suspicious initially because packages were showing up from England with the Royal Mail logo on it. And this is a young woman who doesn't get mail at all, you know, not even junk mail. And so she confronted Alex. Alex then essentially told her part of the truth. But then to hide from her grandmother, she asked Faisal to send the packages to her cousin's house. And they started to have fights, you know, more and more confrontations, until finally her grandmother decided to confiscate her electronics at night. But the problem here is Alex is not a child. She's 23,
right.
And she was 24 when I met her. So there's only so much that the grandmother can do. I'm so impressed with the grandmother. You know, she's a woman that's pushing 70. She had, I think, possibly never heard of Twitter before all of this started. In the course of this, she contacted me after I had met Alex and, you know, done the interview, and we were then writing the article. She contacted me one day and she said, Rukmini, should I be concerned about something called Tumble? She, of course, meant Tumblr, right? And so here's this elderly woman who is trying to master social media, which, you know, which is the realm of the youth. And unbelievably, she's created profiles for herself on Tumblr, on Twitter, on Facebook. And now she's monitoring her like a hawk.
Although Alex doesn't want to stop, right? I mean, that's the key here.
You know, she oscillates. On Saturday, when my story came out, Faisal tried to contact her every which way. He was creating different IDs, you know, flashing her. And what she told me, and I believe her, is that she did not respond. So maybe there's... I believe there's hope for her. I believe that she understands now that this was, you know, not going to take her in a good place. But I think that the very strong undercurrent that is very hard for her is that she now has a hole in her life. You know, her right. best her community of friends has been taken away.
So after investigating this story, Rukmini, what was your takeaway about the online influence, the social media influence of ISIS on young, vulnerable Americans?
I think it's enormous. And, you know, I don't have children myself, but my husband and I were joking that if we ever are lucky enough to have our own kids, no Twitter. No, yeah, no Twitter. But I think it's a tough one. Social media, like I mentioned, is very much the domain of the young. Older people, and I'm talking, you know, even people kind of like in their late 30s and early 40s are not really, unless they're in the media or in politics, they're not really on Twitter. You know, that's not just, that's just not a type of social media engine that that middle-aged people use. And this is where the radicalization is happening. Mm-hmm. And it's just such a challenge, I think, for parents out there.
Rukmini, thank you so much. Stick with us here. Let me bring in another voice from Washington. Alberto Fernandez, he ran the Center for Strategic Counterterrorism Communications at the State Department from March 2012 until this past February. He's now vice president of the Middle East Media Research Institute. Alberto, hello.
Hi, Jane. Happy to be with you.
Well, thank you for being here. You ran a center at the State Department to respond to extremist propaganda. What was the mission of the Strategic Counterterrorism Communications?
Well, it was, of course, started in late 2010, and the idea was that Al-Qaeda, ISIS as an independent entity didn't exist then, that Al-Qaeda prioritized media propaganda, and that the U.S. government really hadn't since 9/11. People had talked about it, but there really had been no emphasis on it. And so the idea was to begin to have an entity that would focus solely on, you know, jihadist propaganda, on the messaging part of Al-Qaeda and friends. Of course, at the time, as I said, you know, ISIS was, of course, Al-Qaeda in Iraq or the Islamic State of Iraq.
Mm. So you've heard Rukmini describe this young woman in Washington State, sort of be sucked into this network of terrorists. ISIS has an enormous cadre of operators on social media. Describe for us, as you worked right in the middle of it, describe for us their online efforts.
Well, it's fascinating. First of all, you have a really large, well-developed process on the ground. I mean, you have video units, you have archives, you have decentralized entities at the state level in ISIS land that produce different types of material, high-quality material. I mean, they have a music production department, even though, of course, they ban music, but there's a certain type of anashid which they can use, and they actually develop that. Mm. So they have a tremendous presence on the ground in their territories in Syria and Iraq that they control. And then they've developed over time. They kind of fell into it in 2013. They've developed this online open source community. Sometimes we call them fanboys, or in Arabic we call them sometimes Fursan al-Tahmil, the Knights of the Uploading, people who emphasize and amplify the ISIS message. So it's a network that's been developed over time. And I think 2013 particularly is the key period when that takes off.
Right. You talk about the video units and the archives, but you've said yourself, I've read, that people are not radicalized by watching videos. It's through the one-on-one human contact, right? So talk about the process of radicalization being intensely personal and how you often find these radicalized groups in clusters.
That's absolutely right. You know, first of all, of course, there is no one way for being radicalized. You know, why does one person decide to take a path of violence and another person doesn't? Why does one person decide to change their religion and another person doesn't? So it's very individualized. It's very intimate. It's very personal. people are, you know, the radicalization process is complex, but generally you have kind of at least two steps. People are exposed to the material. They watch it on television. They watch videos. By the way, not just ISIS videos. Sometimes you'll see, you know, footage of carnage in Syria, for example, was readily available in mainstream media. So people become aware of the thing and they're consuming material. And then there is the intimate personal dimension, the one-on-one dimension. Your brother, as we saw, for example, in Boston, your cousin, your neighbor, your imam,
right,
or somebody you're Skyping with, somebody that you're talking with through social media. So it's that awareness, the consumption of the video, the consumption of the stuff, the argument, and then that one-on-one personal contact, which takes you deeper into the radicalization process. Mm. That, of course, is a process, that one-on-one part, which is very difficult for government to do. And actually, only a few people are kind of combating that in the private sector in the West, doing really good work. But there are very few of them that do that.
Mm. We'll talk more about that in a minute. Let me get a caller in here from Quincy, Mass. Mudafa is on the line. Welcome to On Point.
Hello, Jane.
Hi.
Yeah, I just came back from Iraq. I'm an Iraqi myself. And also, I would like to give some light on the method that ISIS used to recruit people.
Okay.
They mostly take advantage of kind of dysfunctional personality among people, especially young people. So the main factor of recruiting in the East is to face a person with guilt, whether it's going into the wrong path in terms of sexual behavior or drinking alcohol or taking drugs.
Mm-hmm.
Then given that kind of personality, an option either to stay on the path of going down or get a chance of empowerment.
I see. So there are certain personality traits you say ISIS is looking for. Mudafa, thank you. Rukmini, speak to that. Do you agree with that in your investigation? Certain personality traits, some dysfunction that ISIS is looking for?
There's definitely, a share of the ISIS recruits who are petty criminals, former drug addicts, you know, people who have had run-ins with the law. But what I think is telling about the power of their recruiting machinery is that they are also able to draw in people that we would consider successful in Western society. Look at the Birmingham girls. These are three young women who left from Birmingham, England, several months ago to join the Islamic State. One of them was going to medical school. The other two were, you know, we're doing very well in high school. And so, in every one of these cases, you can pull back the curtain and find something, some dysfunction, a fight with a family member, a falling out at work, etc. But in the end, I think that they're able to penetrate a very comprehensive, blanket of society.
Hmm. Alberto Fernandez, you've said that there are great misconceptions in the West, that ISIS is somehow a group of psychopaths, right? But their message is initially at least a very positive one, right?
Yeah, they are psychopaths who are also idealists. I mean, Nazis were idealists, right? There's not a contradiction between one and the other. We often in the West focus so much on the grotesque violence that they practice, which we see all the time. But they're also sending a message relentlessly about building the perfect Muslim state, about building paradise on earth, about recreating this idealized time of the Prophet and the righteously guided caliphs. So for a person who is searching in that field, a young Muslim, that can be intensely attractive. And so we kind of do ourselves a disservice when we think it's only people who are maladjusted or only people who are sick or attracted to violence. I wish it was that easy. The problem would be smaller if that was.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about ISIS's propaganda efforts online and how the U.S. should respond. You can join the conversation. What should our strategy against ISIS be? How can we reach people before they hand over their lives to ISIS? In an interview with The New York Times, Alex, this young woman in Washington State, speaks about her impressions of ISIS after her extensive online conversations with a British man with ties to ISIS.
I don't think that the Islamic State is as bad as everyone says. I think that their atrocities are exaggerated. I think that they brought stability to the land. I think that it might be one of the safest places to live in the Middle East. I don't know if I know the truth about the Islamic State.
We're speaking with New York Times correspondent Rukmini Kalamaki, who interviewed Alex. Her article in Sunday's New York Times was ISIS and the Lonely Young American. Also with Alberto Fernandez, who ran the Center for Strategic Counterterrorism Communications until this past February. So many calls here. Let's get first to Amy in Springfield, Massachusetts. Hi, Amy. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
So I think it's a cut to the chase and look at what underlies the manipulation that's going on, and that's grooming the same way that pedophiles groom. And I encourage every parent to look at the work of Gavin DeBecker, who was the go-to stalking guy under Clinton, who has a 9-page section in his book, The Gift of Fear, on the behaviors of men who manipulate. And when we look at that, and when we teach our daughters and sons how to be strong, how not to be a victim, how to recognize when someone's manipulating you, then we will make a difference on the home front.
Amy, thank you. Rukmini, that thought came to my mind as I read and listened to your investigation, your report, and that this sort of pedophile behavior.
Yeah. You know what? I've not studied pedophile behavior, so I'm not really qualified to make a comparison. But I mean, from the basics of it, I think that both types of recruitment involve drawing close to the victim and convincing them that you are on their side, you're their best friend, you're their most intimate partner, and that's what makes it so insidious and so difficult to get a handle on. Because initially, if anybody looked at Alex's communications with these people, it just looked like friendly banter, and not more.
Here's John in Shrewsbury, Massachusetts. Hi, John. Thanks for calling. Welcome.
Hello, Jane. I want to see whether there's any insight into a parallel situation, maybe a worse one, actually. And that is, we've just finished, or we're still involved, in fighting a war in Iraq based on lies. We're up to 1 million are dead, 4 million are displaced. How many are injured? We don't know. It's amazed me how people were recruited to do that. And I wonder, is there any parallel between the way the U.S. Army, U.S. Armed Forces recruit people to commit that kind of atrocity and the way ISIS recruits? And has the New York Times ever done an article on that? I don't think so. But there certainly is a striking parallel there.
John, thank you.
Given the slaughter throughout the Middle East.
Excellent call. Thank you. Alberto Fernandez, would you tackle that?
Well, that's a kind of a fantasy question. I don't think it merits an answer. But I think there's an important point that is raised about this online behavior. There is information. Alex is saying, you know, the Islamic State is not so bad. It's been exaggerated. The week before James Foley is killed, which is the key element which brings her attraction, ISIS rounded up and beheaded almost 1,000 Sunni Arab Muslims in Deir ez-Zor, part of the Shaytat tribe. And there's a grotesque video of it, of them doing it live, one after another after another. Information and ignorance also plays into it. You know, Alex doesn't know about the Shaytat. She knows about James Foley and about their explanations for that. So people need to be aware of, yes, being groomed and the pedophile concept, but also that, you know, you can always be played, and there are always there's an always another side to a story. And if something sounds too good to be true, it probably is.
Alberto, though, you've talked about these conversations quickly going from Twitter to direct messaging and Skype. And I'm curious, once you track online activity, how hard is it for law enforcement to actually find the people that are waving the bait?
Well, I think there's been a problem. There's a space that ISIS has very cleverly looked at and taken advantage of. And that is that social media is, in a way, an ungoverned space. And I think government all too often has looked at doing a couple of things. One, doing law enforcement, and kind of doing the big picture counter messaging. And so we're kind of misaligned. What's happening here, it's an ideological issue. It's about belief. Not necessarily religious belief. Obviously, religious belief is a big part of it, but belief in a worldview, in a vision for the future. That's kind of hard for a policeman or a diplomat or someone in government to do. Mm-hmm. That's something that's maybe better done by a social counselor or a faith leader or whatever. But it's a little space where they actually do tend to monopolize a conversation.
Peg is calling from New York. Peg, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I kind of went from a dove to a hawk almost overnight with this, because ISIS has tentacles all over the world, and I'm frustrated that when they announced they'd send over 450 troops, I feel that we really need to be more proactive militarily on this, because, as I said, all over the world.
All right, Peg, thank you. I mean, Alberto Fernandez, do you agree? Is it military activity, or could you do a lot to stop ISIS online?
You could do a lot to stop ISIS online, and you should do. There's a lot more that we can do in kind of best practices. But I think the caller is right about one thing. The best propaganda is actually the truth. And ISIS works really hard to make itself look bigger and stronger and spreading than it is. I mean, it is a fact. So anything you can do to chip away at that is I think, a good idea. So, yeah, so military defeat is not not a bad idea.
Rukmini, how do you respond to that?
Well, I can cite the example of what happened with Al-Qaeda and the Islamic Maghreb in Mali in 2013. In 2012, they had invaded the north of this country, and with in alliance with two other jihadist groups, they had taken over half of the country, which is an area the size of Afghanistan. They controlled an area that is, in effect, larger than what ISIS controls today. And French troops came in January of 2013, and I think it took them 3 weeks essentially to flush out the militants. The problem is that once the troops went in, they need to stay in order to keep the jihadists at bay. The troops have now been drawn down, and within the last couple of weeks, we're seeing AQIM-linked terrorist attacks all over Mali, including in places where they hadn't been before, further south than they were before. So that's the catch-22. Military force works, but then does anybody have the stomach to keep boots on the ground in these places essentially forever?
Here's Jim in Newport Township, Illinois. Hi, Jim. Thanks for calling. Welcome.
Yes. And I think the earlier caller's comment definitely would have been justified to give a response, because I feel that the country, our country, led by a whole, by a one-track mind media approach, is not realizing that we're getting deeper into an unwinnable war or conflict. Of course, it's an undeclared war. And here we are a decade and a half after the great escalation of the situation, and now we're told we're at a much greater security risk than we've ever been.
Mm-hmm.
We're chasing our tails and not accomplishing anything. I'm afraid here we are with 40 land bases in the Middle East itself, a fleet in the Mediterranean, another one in the Persian Gulf, and we are the great recruiters of radicalized Islam.
Jim, thank you. Alberto, would you respond?
Well, again, I think these people are conflating a whole series of American misadventures going back for the heart of the matter. I've been critical of U.S. foreign policy on more than one occasion, but I think the reality is that the ISIS, the Takfiri Salafi jihadist worldview, is a worldview that has existed for a long time. And it's had different permutations and it's had different ways of expressing itself. I think Rukmini's right when she's talking about military action, that the problem with military defeat alone is that ISIS and similar groups have been able to present themselves as a legitimate option for a number of Muslims. You know, ISIS in Syria and Iraq postures as the defender, the paladin of Sunni Arab Muslims.
Hmm.
And so if we destroy them tomorrow with a combination of American, coalition, Kurdish, Shia militias, okay, we can destroy them. But what replaces them? Who speaks for those millions who are somehow affected or feel an appeal or an attraction to this message? I just saw an ISIS video yesterday that they put out, and it's about basically how good life is in the Islamic State. And they don't shy away from the enforcement of violence, for legitimate reasons to prevent crime and all kinds of punishments that we would not accept. But for a conservative Sunni Arab Muslim, it's not an unattractive picture that they're presenting. So we need an alternative. There has to be an alternative to that after the day after they no longer are in power.
Here's Carlos in Cincinnati, Ohio. Hi, Carlos. Welcome to On Point.
Hi there.
Hi.
Yes, I worked with kids for many years, the kids 10 to 15 years old. And what we're not teaching, I see, is the values of this country. I am not from here. I have an accent. I came here about 25 years ago to this country, but I learned the values, and I love to love those values. And that is what I'm passing to my kids. Mm-hmm. I mean, we need to teach the kids at an early age, and not to be reactive. I think we need to be a little bit more proactive in our houses, in the schools.
A little more patriotism and love of country is what I hear you saying. Carlos, thank you. Here's Arturo in Boston. Arturo, welcome to On Point.
Thank you. Hi, Jane. How are you doing?
Go ahead.
So I was just saying, I'm 19, so I'm pretty familiar with all the social media.
Yes.
And from my point of view, a good way to fight the whole social media recruitment is, first, you can't have the government go out and say you can't ban it, outright ban it in a public way, because what that does to kids my age, it's banned, let's go find it. And we're pretty good at finding stuff that's banned and with proxies and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And the second thing is that there has to, this point, the government or private, whatever, has to find examples of kids my age who go over or who join, and the negative aspects, because even though it's in the media, they have to have a concrete example, kind of like the story with Alex.
Right.
And
examples of what actually could happen, Arturo. I hear it. Rukmini, is that what you were trying to do, I guess, in the New York Times, right?
Yes, and I think your caller makes a very good point. One of the people who was instrumental in helping Alex, fish herself out of this digital sea where she was being recruited is a man called Mubin Sheikh, and he's a Canadian who is a former extremist himself. In the 1990s, he traveled all the way to Pakistan to meet the Taliban and very much espoused this radical ideology, and then somehow made a U-turn in his own life and decided that he had erred, and
ended up working for Canadian intelligence. And people like him, I think, are people that our government would do well to encourage and perhaps even to fund. He is just kind of freelancing, you know, on Twitter. He's tired of doing it because he said to me, I'm sick of arguing theology with 15-year-olds because that's what's happening. But he was able to say to Alex, listen, I am an extremist. I was an extremist myself. I know these verses from the Quran inside out. I am telling you that they are misleading you. There's different interpretations for these verses on jihad. And he's able to speak from a place of authority, whereas Alex's grandmother at one point wanted me to try to speak to her and tell her about the abuses that women were suffering in the Islamic State. And we know from the Yazidis that surely there's a lot of sexual mistreatment. And I, of course, as you know, as a non-Muslim and as a mostly secular person, just I don't carry that weight. You know, I can tell her as a journalist, this is what Human Rights Watch says. This is what Amnesty says. It doesn't carry the weight of somebody like Mubin Sheikh. And there's a lot of these people. There's a young man in Finland. He goes by the online name of Ibrahima. And back last year, I mean, I used to talk to him. He was one of the most prolific, you know, ISIS fanboys. He gleefully was retweeting the James Foley and the Peter Kasich beheading videos. But there was something about him that wasn't completely sold. And sometime this year, he essentially turned. And he was immediately attacked by the ISIS crowd as being you know, an infidel, became an outcast in their community, and is now, you know, just in a very personal manner online, trying to talk sense to other people like him. He's 19, that, you know, and telling them, look, I was down this path too, and I've realized that it's wrong. Let me tell you why.
Alberto Fernandez, about 20 seconds here, but I know that, you know, ISIS is celebrating its one-year anniversary. How do you see its online presence evolving from here?
Well, I think we need about 1,000 more Mubin Sheikhs. He's a true hero, and that's a model to follow.
Rukmini Kalamaki, how's Alex? Real quick, where's she going from here?
She had a very anxiety-filled weekend. She's very worried that Faisal might try to threaten her. But I think every day she's moving forward, and I hope she's seen the end of this.
Rukmini Kalamaki, correspondent from The New York Times. Such a terrific piece. Thank you for being on today.
Thank you.
Alberto Fernandez, Vice President of the Middle East Media Research Institute. I appreciate your time, Alberto. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.